Find the perfect space for your business with DRK & Company Realty. Flexible office suites are available. Employees and clients benefit from free parking, front door access, and walkable dining, retail, and hotels at the Polaris Lifestyle Center. Managed by DRK & Company Realty, one of Central Ohio's most trusted leaders, this safe, well-maintained property offers dedicated on-site management and responsive maintenance. Grow your business at an address designed for success at 470 Old Worthington Road. Visit drk-realty.com to learn more.
The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is happening now at Sleep Outfitters. This is your chance to save big with up to 65% off mattresses store-wide. Plus, get a free adjustable base with select Sealy mattresses. These limited-time warehouse clearance deals won't last, and with our lifetime price guarantee, you can rest assured you're getting the best deal. The semi-annual warehouse clearance event, only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com to find a store near you.
And welcome to Grazia Life Advice, Grazia's podcast. I'm Rhiannon, and each week I'll be interviewing women worth listening to and getting them to pass on the 6 best pieces of advice they've ever been given, and the worst piece too. Our guest this week is journalist, broadcaster, and eco-lifestyle expert Lucy Siegel. Lucy has recently published her new book, Turning the Tide on Plastic. It's described as an accessible and practical book that not only serves as a much-needed call to arms to end the plastic pandemic, but also gives useful tools on how to make meaningful change in our everyday lives. It can be hard wanting to make those environmental changes, whether that be in plastic or fashion, and knowing how to do it. So this podcast contains loads of great practical advice from Lucy. But we also had a lot of laughs, starting with a discussion about her teenage hair. So over to Lucy. Hi, I'm here with Lucy. Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
You're here to give us your best advice. But first, I just want to talk to you about the book that you have out at the moment, which is Turning the Tide on Plastic.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's obviously all about how we can tackle our plastic problem. And I'm just really interested. There's a stat that they put in your press release, which is astonishing, which is if 12 people, so, you know, we have at least 12 listening here, adopt your reduce, rethink, refill, reuse approach, we can ditch 3 to 15,000 items of plastic a year.
Yeah. So we use so many items of plastic. We're deluged with it. It's like the world is vomiting plastic into our lives. So you and I, because we live in this industrialized economy, we have quite big plastic footprints. In the UK, we're a very supermarket based economy, particularly in urban areas when you're probably relying on a lot of supermarket local versions, light versions, everything's even more wrapped. It's hard to find unwrapped unless you make a consolidated effort. So basically, the good news about that is that you can make a massive dent quite easily. It's the only good thing about having a huge plastic footprint.
Yeah,
but this is where it needs to start, because there are a couple of things that always make people kind of sit up and listen. Firstly, by 2050, if we don't do something now, there'll be more bits of plastic in the ocean than fish.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so that's a bad one. And then if you think between 2002, 2012, during that decade, more plastic was produced than at any other time on Earth. We need to put a pin in this, you might say, okay, because the plastic pandemic, already they drained a bit of the Thames to do some cleaning and they found like 5,000 wet wipes. Wet wipes are a hidden plastic. A lot of people don't even know they've got plastic in them. A lot of people flush them down their loo, which is like playing Russian roulette. If you want a big plumbing bill, that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
So on and on it goes. So basically, it is about taking control of your bin, which I promise you is so liberating, and stopping the flow of plastics going into your lives. My aim personally is not to go plastic free, because I don't think that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
My aim is to have good, useful plastics only in my life.
Right.
And for me, it's about, we are the front line of resistance. If we don't stop, there's more coming. $180 billion was invested into new plastic manufacturing off the back of the shale gas boom in the US. We're connecting ourselves to fossil fuels in a very, very unfortunate way at this point in our history.
It sounds terrifying, but what I like about the book is that it is this practical that we can turn the tide, and it's advice and telling people what they can do and what they should do, which I think is really helpful, because even when you're conscious of it and worried about it, people necessarily still don't know what they're supposed to be doing. So
yeah, so basically I really wanted it to be almost like a discussion like we're having now. It's a conversation, really. Somebody's already said to me, it feels like you're in my living room. I think they meant it in a good way.
Yeah.
And I will come to your living room as well if you want. Okay, I'm available. Good. Just to reinforce the points. But it's a lot of strategies, and it's not just, I haven't just formed them based on my own life, because I don't have kids, for example. So therefore I don't have a good understanding of that flow of plastics and the pressure on families. So I worked with a lot of families, including the Proud family in South Manchester. Hello, Louise, if you're listening, who are absolutely brilliant. You know, a lot of people have let me go through their bins to develop these strategies, for which I'm enormously grateful, which sounds weird, but it's the only way to do it. So instead of the reduce, reuse, recycle mantra, we put far too much emphasis on recycling. It's not working out here in the UK. There's a really big problem with it. I have 8 R's, which don't ask me to say in order because I can't remember them. But it starts with recording the plastic, and then a recycling is at the very, very end, and it includes refill, reimagine, reuse. And it's not rocket science. You know, we can do this. You know, we invented this chemistry in the first place. Now what comes next? So it's about doing what you can to stem the tide of plastic into your home, and then if you want to, amplifying your action and plugging into a global movement, because that's how we get global change. But I do believe, I honestly fervently believe that we're going to do this.
Which is great. And it's a much more positive message than what you see sometimes out there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think there's any point in stewing in our own juice and sort of saying, oh, we're just in a wave of rubbish, you know, and what are we going to do? Stay there. I do think we're very solutions orientated. I'm talking about humans as a species, not just you and me, but I think we are too. But it is about how do we turn all our ingenuity and all our problem solving capacities into creating a solution for this problem. And we can do it. Honestly, this issue, I've covered a lot of issues. I've been on the trail of plastic for about 10 years. I've covered lots of different environmental issues in my time. And this is the only one that I would say 98% of people are concerned about this and ready to do something and are prepared to make small changes. And some of those will then, you know, do big, big changes.
Yeah. So we have more on plastic later, but we're going to go through your pieces of advice, which you've given, which I love because they're really varied and really fun.
I'm a very varied person.
And the first piece is about your hair. So tell me what, and you've said it's outstanding advice.
I think this is possibly the best advice that I've ever been given. And so I still have problematic hair. So my hair is very thick, it's very wiry. I'm not sure where it comes from. There's a lot of discussion about the origins of my hair. And during the 1980s, I grew up in South County Dublin, where the wind and the rain and the humidity conspired to turn my hair into what my friend Celia describes as an isosceles triangle shape. And it was like frizz, but I don't know. I've never seen a substance like it. And it was really extraordinary. And conditioner wasn't really a thing at the time. So honestly, I used to walk through near where I went to school and people would come out of their houses and they'd be like, I see what you mean, Mary.
No.
Yeah, it was like, you know, it was really like, it was a real talking point. So I left Dublin and moved to Manchester, and I was at a very scary school for me because it was huge and I was in the sixth form and I didn't, you know, I was really like shy and everything. Anyway, there was a clique of kind of cool girls who were also quite hard girls. And they were like, you know, they all wanted to be like singers or models or whatever. Anyway, I didn't dare speak to them. And then one day I was like loitering by the radiator, as always, with my huge bouffant hair. And this girl, one of these like, you know, one of these amazing goddesses, like strode over to me, and she was like really purposeful. She strode over to me. I thought, God, she's going to hit me or something. And she stood in front of me and she just looked at me directly in the eyes. And she said to me, you know, when you wash your hair? And I was like, yeah. She said, don't brush it. Let it dry naturally. Turned on her heels, walked off. And I was like, oh my God.
That's amazing.
As soon as I got home, did what she said. And I got these kind of amazing corkscrew curls. Well, they were amazing for the time.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, everything's got context. And I think it changed my life. I think she was called Rachel. Right. And she used to be like so cool that she actually in the holidays went to a recording studio and laid down some tracks.
Oh, she was that girl.
She was that girl. Yeah. So I don't know what happened to her, but I only know what happened to my hair, which is it got better.
That's incredible. Looking very smooth today.
Yeah, well, it's my life's work. It's made, most of my effort goes on my hair and then the remainder goes on solving the plastic pandemic.
That's a good split of time, I think.
It really is.
Did it change your confidence, though? Like, we laugh, but, you know, we talk a lot about at Grazia about how it is important how you look and how you feel sometimes.
Yeah, I think it changed other people's perception of me. So I don't know. I mean, I probably not unwrapped it to the extent that I probably need to. But I always felt like I was okay in myself. I was very accepting of myself and my weird hair. But it was such a relief not to have to worry about it. I could assimilate. Mm-hmm. And I went to lots of different, I went to 15 different schools. Wow. Britain and Ireland. So I had to do a lot of fitting in and the hair meant that I couldn't fit in. Mm. And now I could, although it was right at the end of my school career, so I didn't actually need to anymore. I'm sure it helped with a whole variety of things. Yeah. And I think it once you, because I'd had such like crazy hair, and of course, you know, I was the archetypal musician and flute player and geek and everything. It was all adding up to complete shame. It gave me a way of accessing other stuff. Mm. Like, you know, urban music or fashion.
Yeah.
And it gave me a whole different dimension into my life. It's not that I, you know, I'm still not very big on conformity. I find it impossible to conform. But it was, it was a bit of a barrier, I suppose. Mm. Like it was such massive hair. It was literally physically a barrier.
Oh, you just, like, I don't think kids these days understand the pain of looking back at old photographs of yourself when you were young. Pre-straightener.
Yeah, no straighteners. I mean, you know.
No serum.
No, nothing. Yeah. Like, literally nothing, nothing. Mm. And I still had, especially in Ireland, because a lot of people have troublesome hair in Ireland, or used to. Not now. You go to Dublin and everyone's got, like, this blonde flaxen straight hair. And you're like, that's not real. And it's just like, you know, it was just something that a lot of people struggled with in the weather as well. The weather was a problem. So it did boost my confidence for sure.
I love your second piece of advice because it's just super practical and you're passing it on like Rachel did to you, which is about where to keep your trainers and exercise.
Yes. So this is more contemporary advice. So a few years ago, I had been really, really active, really fit. I'd done loads of sport. And then I just found myself like unable to just motivate myself to do anything. And I work in TV a lot and everyone's always doing triathlons or throwing themselves off a mountain or, you know, raising like a zillion pounds. Yeah. And I was just thinking, oh my God. Like, firstly, I was just overcome, like awestruck by these superhuman feats. Mm. But at the same time, it felt really hard just to go and do a normal workout, like for a normal person. Yeah. And I actually said to one of my colleagues, I just can't do any exercise at the moment. And he said to me, get your trainers. Mm-hmm. First of all, he said, do you have trainers? And he was like, put them next to your bed. When you wake up in the morning, you do need fitness apparel.
Yes.
Like, you know, put that on, put your trainers on, go out the door, whatever the weather, run for 10 minutes in any direction. No okay. pressure. Just get your legs moving, get your feet moving. And that is the key for me. Mm. Everyone has different ways in to exercise, but that for me is to get your feet moving and get your legs moving. Mm. And it works. So, you know, within a really short time, within months, I'd entered the London Marathon.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I did it. I didn't do a good time or anything.
Yeah.
But get your feet moving, get outside, and also get into the British weather. I mean, it's beautiful at the moment, but it's really, really, I don't think enough of us go outside enough.
And honestly, 10 minutes, because we hear all the time, don't we, as a non-runner, just do 10 minutes and do 10 minutes. And did you really feel it build up and it just clicked for you?
Yeah, it works. And basically, you're waking up a lot of your muscles as well. Mm-hmm. And just being out and, you know, first of all, you can't run to the lamppost, whatever. No one's going to watch you.
Yeah.
No one's judging you because now everyone's doing stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. And then it is about building it up and, you know, very slowly. And you go at your pace. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I learned very, very early on. I did a half marathon and there were signs all around going, let me get this right now, my pace, not yours, or something like that. So it's like, okay, you know, you've always got to run at your own speed, because that's what happens. People kind of blast off. They're super competitive with themselves and they put so much pressure on themselves and then they stop doing it. But I've just had another sabbatical where I didn't run for ages. And then, you know, I got out there yesterday and just went for it.
And you notice the change in your mental health as much as physical health?
Much more in my mental health than my physical health.
Right.
I noticed very little change in my physical self these days. But I do realise that actually it's the rhythm of it, and the problem solving is what I get from running. I feel like I'm really talking up my running now. I'm so slow.
You've got a marathon,
so rubbish.
So you get to do that for the rest of your life. I think that's like a blag you get, definitely.
Yeah, but you do need to, you know, you can get into that cycle and it's really powerful. It's like an amazing sort of mental detox, I think. Whatever length or distance you want to go. For me, I found that I'm a long distance runner.
Yeah. And your third piece of advice is also very practical around exercise, and it's what you should wear underneath your clothes.
Yes, so these are sort of connected, but during the 90s, everything's during the 90s, I was an aerobics instructor.
Were you really how long were you an aerobics instructor
for? Years. Wow. Like, while I had a job in a textiles factory in South London, and in the evenings I used to go and teach aerobics. So which meant I burned a lot of calories, so I was constantly eating at my desk, which used to drive my line manager absolutely insane, because I was like a gerbil. I was always eating because I couldn't get enough calories in. And it, for me, I really liked music, so I was really into house music and stuff like that, and I liked the beat, and I liked the fact that, you know, you had these big classes full of women and you'd all move in the same direction, and it was just really fun. But, you know, to be fair, I did a week's course training to be an aerobics instructor. I didn't really know that much about the human body, and I probably shouldn't have been put in charge of people's physical welfare.
This is the most 90s story ever.
I'm just the 90s. And now I go to classes and people are so well trained, and they've invested, you know, that it's their profession. The fitness industry wasn't like that then, and the classes are so good and they're so woman centric. Like, in those days it was basically taking exercise for men and converting it was still very keep fit, which is a phrase I hate. Anyway, so I was doing my course, and then I was doing some training afterwards, starting to teach these aerobics lessons, and there was a girl, I think she was actually a neuroscientist, who was an aerobics teacher on the circuit, and she was hilariously funny. And she came up to me, she sort of looked me up and down, she looked at my rather sizable chest, and she said to me, always wear two sports bras. Double up.
Two.
Yeah. She was like, you know what I mean.
Okay.
And I'm glad I did that.
Do you still wear two always? They're better, better now.
They're not. This is a myth. Yeah. It's a myth that sports bras have got any better. They are the same, if not worse.
Really?
Yes. They're useless. If I wasn't busy with the plastic thing, then I would be designing sports bras.
That's for later. When you solve plastics.
Yeah, when I solve plastics, I'll solve movement in that area.
Someone needs to do it. You're right.
They do.
Yeah.
Honestly, some of the things that are put out on the market as sports bras are just a joke.
Yeah, that little crop top's not going to do anything.
No. Useless.
Your fourth piece of advice, it sounds simple, but it kind of means more. It says you play the ball, is what you've said. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so when I was in my sort of late 20s, I started to play tennis very late because I never played at school. And I actually really liked it, but I really found that I was really competitive and I was really angry. In fact, I have a scar on my leg where I hit myself in the leg with my own racket with such force that I actually dented my own leg.
Amazing.
So I had to think, why am I so angry? And it was like I was projecting all this anger. Anyway, somebody said to me, play the ball. And I think in a lot of sport, you get very, especially if you're opposite somebody, you can start to think very evil thoughts about that person and you project all your negativity onto them. In tennis, if you subscribe to this philosophy, you're just playing the ball, not that person. That person is kind of neutral. That person, your anger has no place on that person. It is all about this little tennis ball, this little luminous thing flying through the air. And for some reason, I found that a really meditative concept, and I found it to be really helpful in other areas of my life where I might personalize issues, or I might start to think, oh, that person's my my enemy or foe. Yeah. A lot of the time, it's just that you're in a situation, you know, you're in a, both in a situation, you might be on opposite sides of the spectrum. You find it a lot with activism around environmental issues or whatever they are. There will be two sides to this debate and you're playing the issue, not the other person.
Yeah. That's hard to remember though, if someone's totally opposite to you. I mean, you must get a lot of naysayers and kind of like, you know, anti-climate change people, and you're coming up against big corporations as well.
Oh, the anti-climate change people, they're just mad. Yeah. I mean, that's, come on. I mean, it's a settled science. I mean, you know, there's like, what are that, like 1,999 reports by peer-reviewed scientists, and then there's two which have been shown to be funded by, you know, pro-global warming bodies. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots of, yeah, there's lots of debate. But I think where there's genuine dissent, so for example, say if you take the plastics debate, a lot of people might be resistant to change because they fear change. Lots of people fear change. Or it might be socioeconomic, it might be financial, it might be that they don't live anywhere near a lovely plastic-free, very woke bulk buy store. You know, so there are lots of different reasons why people are resistant to change. And I feel that most reasonable people, if you explain the issue and their place and give them lots of a variety of solutions and a variety of ways in, rather than saying, this is bad, you're evil. I do think that I kind of don't like that whole really, really polarized debate. And every time you go on a TV show, it's set up like a Punch and Judy show.
Yeah.
Especially around climate change. It's so pointless.
Yeah. It's the need for this. We have a strange idea about balance, don't we? As if balance is like finding someone saying something interesting and then finding someone saying the opposite.
Yeah, which, you know, unfortunately, you know, media organisations. I mean, it's important that we are, there's some amazing reporting and some amazing, very clear-sighted reporting that manages to be completely unbiased. But climate change is a settled science. So every time they bring out that balance argument, which fortunately the BBC stopped doing now, but then they used to wheel on some foaming at the mouth lunatic or someone who was clearly being paid by whichever oil company or whatever. I mean, it was just a joke. You know, and then you did feel like you're in a pantomime. So what's the point?
Yeah.
Because personally, I cannot impart information that's useful to people if it's just a caricature.
Yeah.
I'm not a person who can just run through the lines. I feel it. And every time I speak is different because I want to communicate with that audience, not, you know, I don't have a pre-prepared statement that I can banter around with Piers Morgan or whatever.
No. And if you're having to tackle a Piers or someone like that, you're not really discussing the issue that you came to discuss, really, are you? Because you're too busy batting away allegations.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's just, yes, can you be bothered? I remember years ago doing one of those Sunday morning programs with it was a little bit livelier then, with a friend of mine. And when we got there, first of all, you have to get up at 4 a.m. To drive to the studio in Birmingham. And then we were surrounded by people who were shouting like they didn't, hated gay marriage or whatever. And she just looked at me and I just looked at her and she was like, what are we doing here? And she was like, I can't get really worked up about this because their position is so preposterous. It's really hard to like get equally worked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing as well, I think.
Your fifth piece of advice does talk about plastic, and it's about what your granddad said to you. So a while ago, I presume he spoke to you about plastic, says when you were a child.
When I was seven or eight, yes. And this is why my whole book started from this point, really. So I had 100% approval rating with my grandparents.
Okay.
Everything I did was absolutely brilliant and whatever, you know. And then I always used to go and stay with them in the summer. And I went to stay with them and I can't really remember. I think it was like a drinking bottle that I had that my neighbours brought me back from Disneyland. And it like had a plastic Mickey Mouse or whatever and a straw and a blah, blah, blah. And then I also, to top off my look, I had like a headband with some plastic protruding antennae from it.
Dealy bopper.
Yeah. I was just covered in plastic, clutching a Barbie, Lego, you know, everything was plastic. Yeah. And something came on the television for a new plastic thing that you could put in your washing machine like a dosing ball, which now we all use. And it was a new thing. And I said, oh, that's cool. And my granddad said, that is not cool. My granddad said, plastic is made from oil and oil is a precious resource. We should only be using plastic for things that are very important to us. And he used to go to the supermarket. He lived in Chester in the Northwest. And he used to unwrap his groceries there at the checkout and leave the plastic behind. He would never take a plastic bag.
Really?
I always used to think it was really weird and really embarrassing. And the weird thing was that he worked for an oil company.
I was going to say, where did that knowledge come from? But yeah.
Yeah. So day in, day out, he was dealing with, he was a scientific translator. So he would see a lot of reports and translate them into different languages or whatever. So he had a very good understanding of oil, where it was deposited. Mm. And at the time and throughout the 70s, they were talking about peak oil. So when we would run out of oil. So he was coming at it from a slightly different position, but it planted a seed in my head. And I think I've always had this curiosity ever since. Everything we wear, everything we consume, I always want to know the story behind it. It's exhausting.
Yeah. Is it exhausting or is it interesting?
It's really interesting. It's fascinating. Yeah. So, you know, in journalism, the classic advice that we're all given is follow the money. Mm. I've always followed the oil, which I think is also money.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of environmental route to a lot of stories. Mm. And I think what we've been able to do as writers who are interested in the limits that the planet is setting or needs to set, we have been able to use everyday products to make those stories really come to life over the last few years. When I first came into writing about the environment, it was very abstract.
Yeah.
And I think being able to relate it to people's everyday lives has been a game changer. And of course, now people come up to me all the time and they're like, is this all right? Is this okay? Which is often a very complex set of situations. But it's nice to be able to give them some advice. And that's what I've been able to do with the plastic pandemic, because my research, maybe subliminally going on since I was 7 years of age, means that I feel like I have an authority.
Which is important these days, because not everybody talking about something has an authority.
No, and it's hard to talk about stuff when you don't have an authority, or you've got a bit of authority, but in a very niche area. With plastics, I guess we all have a bit of an authority because we all use so much and we see it all the time. But that makes it easy for me because people can grasp what I'm talking about very quickly.
Can I ask you about something people do also know you for, which is fashion and looking at ethical fashion and where our fashion is coming from? Are we getting better? All the brands claim they're getting better. Of course they are. It's a great PR move for them. Do you think we're getting better with our fashion?
No. I think a lot of the brands are leading us down a blind alley, actually. I mean, we've got a situation now where in the past few weeks we've had brands, luxury and fast fashion, talking about how they've had to burn stock because they're producing so much inventory. And of course, there's so many clothes coming onto the market. But this is not an environmental statement. This is more of a problem for designers, you know, and brands. Everyone's telling me they find it difficult to shift product anyway. So it is a real problem. That overproduction glut is something that's a bit like food waste. It is symptomatic of a problem in the system, of a sick system. So I think there are incremental changes. There's a lot more small brands around. There's a lot more ethical brands around. There's a lot of ingenuity. And I think that's coming from people, younger generations moving into the fashion industry and wanting to do something a different way, seeing it failing and having different values. But I think overall, the landscape is still dominated by these sclerotic, not quite working systems of production. And until we take a hammer to those and reinvent them, I think we're going to be in a problematic zone.
Because at the moment it does feel like, as you kind of touched on, the onus is on the consumer to shop in the right places, to look into everything. Whereas really, I think for big change, don't we need the big brands to make those changes?
Yeah, I mean, it would be incredible if they did, but they probably, if truth be told, they'd be offering you a different product. So a lot of people will say to me, with fashion, for example, can I get this, whatever this is, but ethical? And it probably won't be exactly the same because it may not be as fashionable, because a part of an ethical fashion season is that you might have to put your order in, you know, 3 or 4 months ahead, so that the factory's got time to plan. The problem is the system's very quick as well. Or it might be more expensive, or it might be made of a different fibre and one that doesn't tuck you in the place that you like, or doesn't, you know, doesn't. And it's about getting used to different things as well. Different systems bring different products. But, I mean, the advice remains the same for me from consumers: only buy what you love. And you shouldn't really have anything that you don't love. So I've always used the 30 wears rule.
Yeah.
So I don't care where you buy it from. And I understand people have got different price points and different places that they shop and can get to, or different aesthetics. But can you honestly commit to that 30 times? If not, you can't have it.
Yeah, that's a really good rule. And that's just a really key piece of advice that people can keep in their heads.
Oh, it's so, that's so easy. Yeah.
Do you find people, your friends, your family, being careful what they wear around you? Or are worried that you're going to say, oh, why have you got that from there? And
yeah, I mean, sometimes the room goes a bit quiet, but and now what I hear before I enter a room is a lot of rustling. I know what you're doing. You're hiding the plastic. I will find it.
Yeah.
But it is quite funny. And then with food as well, like ages ago, I went to stay with a friend of mine who had been at college with. There was, you know, there was like 3 or 4 of us who used to hang out at college. And then we all went to stay at her house. And she said to a mutual friend, what does she eat? Like, what do I eat? Like, I'm not an alien.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just really funny. But yeah, it's all of those things. It can be, because consumerism, and this is one of the sad things. It's like consumerism has hooked us in such a way that it starts to define you. And then when somebody says anything or critiques something about anything that you're doing, you can become really defensive, because you know, nobody likes to be critiqued. And once you feel something's part of your personality, and if you shop in a particular place, you know, you might feel that that brand comes to represent who you are. It doesn't.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the good things now is that people are so disloyal to brands.
Yeah.
That's actually brilliant for my purposes. And it gets us over that, you know, over that quite quickly. And also, I do try and do it in a very human way. We're all so fallible, you know, we're all hypocrites, we're all fallible. And like you said before, I don't think all the onus should be on our shoulders anyway. So I try and go as high up the brand chain as I can.
Yeah.
There's people making serious money out of all of this, and they need to be accountable.
Yeah. I don't know how I can link to your sixth piece of advice. So I'm just going to have to get you to explain it.
Oh, this is my puzzling advice.
Yeah.
So I was thinking in preparation for this, I was just thinking how about weird bits of advice I've been given. And I felt like I could have done with more advice. Like, people could have given me more advice in my life. And what is it about me that means that people don't give me much advice?
Yeah.
Anyway, one really puzzling bit of advice was, I was about to come to London to go to university. I was 17, and my parents had some friends round, and I think his name was Rob. He was a really nice guy. He's kind of elderly architect or something. And he suddenly said at dinner, he kind of looked at me, pointed at me across the table, and he said, "Don't get into crack." With, you know, he was really, really fervent in his belief that I should not get into crack. And I don't know, I just thought this was unnecessary, because as I've already described to you, with the kind of, you know, frizzy hair and the, maybe it's because I'd stopped having frizzy hair, but and my music and all of that kind of stuff. I don't know, I probably wasn't high risk for the crack lifestyle. But I just love it when people are like going away to college or going away, blah, 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 that this kind of unwarranted advice comes their way.
Yeah.
Maybe it saved me. I don't know. I never got into crack. Okay, so maybe it saved me.
Just for the record.
Yeah, just for the record.
It reminds me of, on the Frank Ocean's Blonde album, he has a track where it's just like a mum leaving a voicemail about don't smoke weed. And it goes on for ages and it's brilliant. I think it's just universal, isn't it?
It is universal. But don't smoke weed is good advice, maybe, you know, probably. But, you know, I don't want to get into what drugs people have and haven't done, but crack was just setting the bar so high. And also, it sort of says that everything else is okay apart from crack.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's also quite dangerous. It's puzzling advice. It's dangerous advice. Yeah. But I love it. And I always remember that moment.
Mm, that's brilliant. I feel like we've already had some terrible advice, but yeah. we do like to end on the worst piece of advice you've ever been given. And what was that?
I want to be careful here because I don't want to identify the person who gave me this because they're such a brilliant person. Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, I became a writer first, or started working in magazines first, and I loved journalism and writing stuff. And I've always thought that the environment needed that lens, mm-hmm. because there was a lot of enthusiastic amateurs or people who liked to talk about the science but didn't know how to make anything palatable or interesting or entertaining. We're all in the entertainment industry at the end of the day, which I know is difficult for scientists. So anyway, I started to specialise in eco-living. So I was like an agony aunt for the environment, if you like. And an editor, a very senior, very respected editor, found out I was doing this and sort of rushed over to me and said, God, you know, get yourself out of that as soon as you can.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's boring, it's worthy. You want to, you know, you want to forge on with a bright career. You know, you could write about, I don't know, like entertainment.
Yeah.
You could write about celebrities. And I thought, oh God, you know, maybe this is really bad. And I did get a lot of flack at the start for it being a really kind of worthy proposition. Anyway, about 2 months later, I think my initial column was nominated for a British Press Award. And it was like, everyone was like, everyone should be doing this. It's really important. And then this very senior editor rang me up in a great panic saying, you didn't take that advice I gave you, did you? Because it was terrible, terrible advice. It's like the worst advice ever. So they already called it. And I was like, no, I didn't take it. Yeah. But that column ran for 14 years, which in an age of longevity. Crazy. And paying the bills, you know, that was great, you know.
That's amazing, isn't it? Because, and I think we do forget that it's only recently that it has become cool to be eco, you know. There was the kind of 90s view of it that it wasn't necessarily that cool.
It goes in and out, to be honest. You know, after the recession, obviously, you know, a lot of that stuff seemed really too superfluous when people are just trying to like stay on 2 feet. So it does go in and out, and you do have to worry about that. But I think now it's so consolidated. There are so many great environmental writers. There's a lot of people online. There's a lot of people who do incredible work, especially around climate change. On social media, for example, and there is a live discussion day and night about how the planet's changing and our response to it. None of that existed then. No. So I feel like we're in a much healthier place as far as discussion goes and applying pressure, which is what we all really need to do. There's lots of different ways of being an activist as well. You know, it's not, everyone's not a placard waving. Mm. And I think we've got a much more nuanced, subtle understanding that you should match your activism to your temperament these days.
Definitely. Well, we're glad you didn't take that advice, Lisa. Thank you very much. Thanks so much to Lucy. I absolutely loved chatting to her, as you can tell by all my laughing. I think she's a really realistically inspiring person to take advice from. She's not overly preachy. She just kind of has all those facts that make you want to do something to make a change. Of course, you can get more advice from her in her book, Turning the Tide on Plastic, which is out now. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please do subscribe. Please rate us, review us. It really helps us spread the word. We look forward to seeing you next week for more advice from women worth listening to.
Find the perfect space for your business with DRK and Company Realty. Flexible office suites are available. Employees and clients benefit from free parking, front door access, and walkable dining, retail, and hotels at the Polaris Lifestyle Center. Managed by DRK and Company Realty, one of Central Ohio's most trusted leaders, this safe, well-maintained property offers dedicated on-site management and responsive maintenance. Grow your business at an address designed for success at 470 Old Worthington Road. Visit drk-realty.com to learn more.
The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is on at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,000 store-wide with our lifetime price guarantee and 100% comfort guarantee. Why shop anywhere else? Limited time clearance savings only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com.